Hi, this is Berlin Review. A quick word before we start. Berlin Review is a small magazine with a wide reach. Every week we bring you stories from writers and thinkers from around the world, and we pay them all through subscriptions. That's also how we support our team of editors and translators, everyone on staff. If you've enjoyed listening to Airlift and reading the stories in the magazine, please consider subscribing at blnreview.de. It's the whole reason we can continue doing this work. Okay, here's the show. Hi, I'm Tobias Hamburghorn. You're listening to Airlift from Berlin Review. Here's a story you probably know, even if you've never read it. Someone grows up poor. She becomes a writer. She escapes her class by writing about her upbringing with a mix of shame, guilt, and pride. From Great Expectations to Annie Ernaux to Hillbilly Elegy, this is one of the most classic genres in modern literature. Our guest today has written one of the most acclaimed versions of this story. Claudia Durastanti's novel La Straniera was a finalist for the Premio Strega in Italy. The English translation Strangers I Know received a Pen Award. Claudia was born in Brooklyn to an Italian immigrant's family in the 80s. Then her mother moved back with her and she grew up in rural southern Italy. She now lives in Rome, where she writes and translates, including the latest Italian edition of The Great Gatsby. Claudia Durastanti made her name telling a story of someone who escapes her class, but in her recent essay for Berlin Review, she talks about why there is a problem with this particular genre, the one the French call transfuge de classe. As these working-class novels have gotten more popular in recent years, the reality of being able to achieve upward mobility has only narrowed. Today, Claudia talks with my co-host Lauren Euler about what the genre gets wrong and what stories might be told instead. Here's the conversation.
Hi, Claudia.
Hi, Lauren.
I'm very excited to talk to you about your piece. Where did the idea for it come from?
Yeah, I'm working on a new collection of essays, and I wrote extensively about my class upbringing and strangers I know. But I was writing from a very different position. I still believed that social mobility worked in the same way. It worked for me. I could attend a public school. I received many scholarships. I made it in a way, in the way typical class migrants make it. But then all of a sudden, when I was addressing class again, I found a different tone, which was a little bit more spiteful, perhaps. And maybe I'm projecting, but I realized that even my life couldn't be possible under the new social, political, and economical conditions. And then I'm like, why, especially after Annie Ernaux's novel, a lot of people felt more free and bold in writing about their own class upbringing, but they're still referencing A Man's Place, which was written in the 80s. And so it felt, if everything in the background in the scenario that's surrounding you is different, how can you still write a class migrant narrative with the same tropes and features? It's something that I did. So 7 years later, it was from that book, it was a way to come back to it. And thinking, would I write this differently now? And I think I would, especially because my social mobility path stabilized a little bit. And so I feel, in a way, that it's time to make space for other genre within working class literature, which feels a little bit hijacked from class migrants' tales.
Okay, so you're saying that working class literature has been kind of dominated by what you argue in the piece is kind of auto-fictional, or the French term that is often used is transfuge de classe narrative, which from an Anglophone world is kind of like a rags to riches story, but like a little bit more sociological and like a little bit more realistic, right? And you talk about how the genre has exploded in France in the last 10 years. Can you describe a little bit about like how we know that and why you think that's happened?
In France, I think the phenomenon was the class discourse is extensively present in literature and sociology. And Didier Eribon are sociologists themselves in a way. So it's something more familiar. The reason why I think it booms is because at one point it becomes simply popular. And, you know, the Nobel Prize to Annie Ernaux, in her speech, she said, "I'm writing for the millions of people like me." And also saying millions is interesting because she's speaking about a generation where, you know, social mobility was really relevant for masses, you know, millions of people. That's no longer the case. So something becomes more seen, nominated, represented in a time frame or political frame where the very experience of social mobility is not possible as such. A lot of it could be explained in terms of nostalgia also, which was a big, you know, if we have to talk about feelings, was something that was really big. And I think the boom is also because nostalgia is safe, you know, talking about the origins, the background, the grandparents, the past factories, past poverty doesn't create the same kind of reactive, negative feelings that it would if it was applied so much on the past. So I think the boom of transfuge the class is related to the fact that you can talk about it because you're no longer there.
So you said something interesting just now when you're talking about your own book, and that you became spiteful because when you wrote what in English is translated as Strangers I Know, you talk about your background, your parents, and you have a kind of like a bit of an alienation from your past, but also you're also alienated from your new class a little bit, right? Like, this is the general trajectory of these kinds of books. And you said that you would, I think what was interesting that you just said was that you would write it differently today. And I wanted to kind of push on that because there's like two competing narratives here, right? Which is that you're saying like my trajectory, upward trajectory, would not be possible today. And also I would describe my upward trajectory in a different tone if I were writing about it today as opposed to when you were writing about it in the 2010s, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that account of upward mobility was, in a way, a classic account, as you said. Mm-hmm. So it was heavily influenced by moral feelings, shame and guilt, and the imposter syndrome. Whereas if I had to write about it today, or I was living that condition today, I would realize that it would not be such a linear process. There's also the possibility of coming back. So landing in the middle class is not so, it's a one-way ride as it used to be in a lot of, you know, transfuge class typical books. And I think when I was writing that, I was not necessarily thinking of myself as a political subject so much. And the paradox is that right now that I no longer belong to that class, I'm starting to think, are these accounts necessarily political? Or are they more interested in analyzing shame and guilt compared to what's the political trajectory? Do you want to make other readers identify with your story, recognize themselves? Or are you trying to, you know, make space and arguments for what's the new social mobility? And of course, I'm talking about something that comes from, you know, the rural areas of southern Italy. I have a little bit of migrant story. And so when I say that the social mobility that applied to me is no longer working, of course, I'm not taking it into consideration in new migrant movements into Europe. So right. I'm not talking about that, but it's more about would another me be possible? And when you realize that's no longer the case, I think the tone changes deeply, of course.
Yeah. And can we talk a little bit about what you mean by political and like this, you know, the tension? I think that, you know, there's kind of like a facile tension between like what's quote unquote literary and what's quote unquote political, right? And you write in this essay, "It seems that in order to be considered truly literary, trans class writing is expected not to be too overtly political." And I'm wondering, like, what exactly you mean specifically by, like, what is political working class literature, and what is the difference between political working class literature and literature that represents the working class?
So I think my open critique was with this, you know, double bind between the class discourse and the fact that is usually formatted into auto-fictional or is relating to the factory that was, you know, the working in the fields of the grandparents. In the piece, I argued that middle class writers and working class writers who specialized in transfusion class narratives are both deeply interested in this idea of guilt about the money or shame about, you know, betraying your own circumstances. The very idea of being, you know, authentic is really, it was really important, I think, up to my generation, to the millennials. And so when this, even this idea of selling out fades, what happens to being a political subject in your own class account? So I think when we say political novel, I was at the Working Class Literature Festival. There's this festival in Italy. This year was the fourth edition. So the first year we had a panel and we were talking extensively about Ernaux, Edouard Louis, Didier Eribon, of course. And then a guy came up to me later and he said, okay, you've talked a lot about memoirs and autofictions, but where's the working class novel? And I didn't have a particularly creative answer, but I was thinking about Elena Ferrante's, especially the third volume, which is extensively focused on life in the factory in the 70s and the discovery of the feminist roots. And I would say that that's a little bit more stereotypical, but I consider it as a more advanced pedagogical and political result in a way, because it appeals both to readers who are working class or who are not working class, and it creates a wider network in thinking about what social change is. And I think it reaches that because it doesn't focus so much in the personal perspective. And so it allows for more space, which is not only identification or projecting yourself into a character, but radically imagining yourself, even if you come from a very different account of life in the life of another, basically what you consider imagining yourself in very different circumstances. And I think that when there's that space in that room, then you start thinking, what are the social, economical connections? What can be done? And I love memoirs that don't do that, but I wish for them to not be presented as political fiction about class and not necessarily you living under certain circumstances, me being underclass and me starting to think about being an underclass and caring for other people like me. It was a very, very extensive, long project. And maybe it could also have not happened. I don't know how you feel about that, but being an interpreter of your circumstances is not necessarily something that happens just because you lived them. And so sometimes I feel that right now the stakes are very low. The expectations with transfusion class memoirs and which have boomed, especially after Annie Ernaux's novel, are really just the simple story of where you come from and where you're going, but not like portraying a wider picture. So to me, that room and space and the wider frame is what makes a novel political.
You say something about, you know, I think you're talking about the nature of like the political memoir, the political novel, like, and you say working class or lower class literature is like almost taken as political, like per se, like as it just always yes. is, right? And I wonder if you could expand on that, like why that is, like why also, I mean, even like, I'm sure you have this experience as well. Like, you know, if I'm in a intelligentsia type milieu or like an upper class milieu, and then someone says, oh, where are you from? And I say West Virginia, everyone's like, ah, like a real person is here. A real person has really? Arrived, you know? And they want yeah. to like hear all about it, right? And I also have like, you know, I think it's different than from you, which is like people are always say, oh, you should write about this. You should write about this. And I'm like, I don't want to. But I think it's coming from the same place that you identify, which is that the literary world broadly, which is like the market, critics, journalists, whatever, tend to come from upper class backgrounds, and they see like lower class people as like inherently like authentic or inherently political, right? And I wonder if you could expand on why you think that is.
Yes, because you're doing the work for them. No way. So I think my answer really gravitates around the idea of labor and work when we write fiction or when we write a story. We often think that autofiction has a higher cost in terms of production because we are, you know, going digging in our past. We are trying to elaborate very complex personal experiences, but crafting a novel is damn hard, you know? And so in a way, what I feel that autofictional is less costly in terms, not in terms of work, but in terms of extracting materials, let's say. So what we think is a very complex genre because it requires a lot of, you know, psychological and analytical work. I often find, especially when I'm late with a deadline and I have to write a piece, I suddenly switch to the personal eye mode because it takes less time compared to crafting a proper, let's say, scene or fictional scene or an essay. So I don't blame at all like working class writers who have bought into this auto-fictional mode, maybe for, you know, taste or interest, but also with the idea that it's, it has a different value and you can make more money out of that. So I'm not trying to guilt shame authors who do that, because for a working class writer right now, writing in the auto-fictional mode compared to the novel, unless you're not writing a romanticy or a crime novel, or it's not rewarding so much. And what rewards acknowledgement from the establishment, money comes in. And so I just wanted to say that because I think a lot of working class authors are aware that when they enter a scene and they are to play the authentic card, they can also playfully play with it in a way. And they can also maybe consciously diminish the political tone because they know that up a certain point is not interesting. So I've seen how working class literature is received when it focuses a lot on work, on labor in the present. And it's less attractive. I must say that it feels less sexy for the kind of people you were talking to, because they are still fetishizing this idea of, you know, the origins, where you come from, because in a way, taking care of the subject does the work for you. And I think that they can easily think that allowing for this work to be out there is due in something. And which is to me quite a paradox right now. I don't know how you feel about it, but when I wrote Strangers I Know, I still thought that being seen or represented in fiction had a certain value in the outside world. But now that the literacy, you know, the stats on literature, literary fiction particularly, if we don't go into genre fiction, are so low, I'm wondering, would a working class girl like me still believe in this idea of representation being seen? Will she still look at the novel or a memoir that is openly discussed in literary society as the place where she wants to be? And I'm not sure about that. Maybe we're also projecting that the kind of cultural establishment is the same of, you know, the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I think that has radically changed over even the past 5-10 years. So why are we still handling this kind of representation as deeply important? We write these books, who reads them?
Yeah.
So if you're not writing for a working class audience, you already know that you're kind of a reader is a person that is trying to place you in a very specific spot. And how can you write without being angry or aware, or as you do, like not wanting to play that role or write about it at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think too, like, is the idea of representation, it became popular for millennials during the sort of identity politics crisis of the 2010s, right? And the idea of representation of marginalized identities of whatever kind, racialized identities, different like sexual orientations, this was like the main push in the 2010s. What do you think is the relationship between class and identity as it's constructed, right? Like is being a working class writer like an identity that you can just like, you know, choose or not? Or is there something about the material conditions of class which, you know, may change as class migrants show? I find it like it would be silly and kind of like absurd for me to identify as a working class writer at this point, because I am no longer working class, right? I had this experience when I was young, but, you know, I got out of it.
Yeah, it's interesting for me in Italy, of course, you had a strong up until the end of the 70s, you had, you know, a very stable and fixed idea of who the working class author and writer was, and usually white man working in a factory, didn't become a class migrant at all. But, you know, it was like a status and a condition where you can still get a dignified pay. You would also have a very deep, rich cultural life. And so right now, even in the working class writers system, I would say that there's a hierarchy. So if you're like myself, you were underclass, you come from parents who never worked, you come from the South, there's even a deep disconnection between you. The factories were in the North. In the South, we had no factories and we had no mines, nothing that was shut off. People were underemployed. So even that doesn't buy your a slot, let's say, into a sort of working class royalty. Right now, that I no longer belong to that class, perhaps I have a more straightforward vision in a way. And I think nobody can elude the conditions they were born in, but they have to have the guts and the honesty to acknowledge when these are no longer playing a factor in a writer's life. And I mean, I don't know if it's because I'm jealous, but I kind of am envious of the authors who are capable to reconnect to their roots or origins in a very steady way for a long, long life. You know, there are writers who can still write working class novels, although they have not been working class for, let's say, 20, 30 years. So to me, that's a fascinating process. But if you, like me, have a more hybrid way of being into literature, it would feel weird, especially because it becomes deeply fictional in a way. And also I'm asking why there's no interest in talking about the experience of being a class migrant. And then all of a sudden the circumstances have changed and you go back to that. But after you were no longer working class, or is there a way to become working class again after you have not been a working class for a long, long time? I think it's what the French call déclassement.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, this idea of déclassamento is not finding a proper representation in whether it's autofiction or novels. And I'm asking also you, why do you think that happens? Why is it not this is not interesting,
well,
you know, the
well,
fact that I'm going back.
I think because you sort of touched on this before and your essay touches on this quite a lot, which is that the affective experience of trans-class narrative, upwardly mobile trans-class narrative, is still one of shame and guilt, at least as it's represented in these memoirs and autofictional narratives, right? And that, to me, is not really my experience. And I think, too, like, the thing that I was thinking while I was reading your essay is older writers or writers of a previous generation don't represent like the possibility of going back, because actually, you know, maybe they want to go back and like mine their families and their communities for more stories. But like in general, like, and I think that this is a political claim, it's better to have more money. Like, it's better. You don't want to go back. Right. And also, I think, like, if you are a writer or you're someone who values the life of the mind, there is an inherent value in, like, living a life that is urban. You have some disposable income so that you can go to the theater, so that you can go to the cinema, so that you can buy books. I would consider education and access to culture like privileges in themselves. And so if your primary experience of upward mobility as a working class or lower class person is at least the affectation of shame and guilt. You know, you've betrayed your poor parents and your poor community, and now you're like murdering them by writing about them. If that's like your belief, which I think is kind of like a stereotype, right? Like, I think you say at some point the trope is, what do you say? It's quite funny. I made it, never went back, and now I have to kill everyone I love. Like, that's the trope.
Yeah.
It both prevents you from kind of going back narratively, but also I think, like, if you do a little bit of psychoanalysis on this, it reveals that, like, actually these people don't want to go back. They would have just done it, right?
Yeah, but yeah. What if you're forcefully going back? I feel that a lot of people in our, you know, like, industry or whatever we want to call it have not realized that this might be an increasing possibility.
Well,
perhaps.
I guess, like, I guess the second part of my point, I got distracted as I do,
yeah.
Is that like the shame and guilt that struck these narratives, I think the guilt is a bit overplayed and the shame is a bit underplayed. And the shame is like, I actually don't like that I can't always pronounce everything because I like got so much of my education like virtually when I was young, right? And I don't actually like I still don't know the codes and the way that I speak, sometimes you can still hear the accent or like I cuss all the time, you know, like that's actually like shameful. And so if you have to go back, it would take quite a lot of bravery to write a memoir about this. And, you know, by its nature, and your piece also touches on this, the, you know, the upward mobility is what allows you to have the time and space to write a book. So if you are downwardly mobile and you have to take a bar job in your like shitty like hometown or whatever, you're not going to have the time or the energy to expand your mind to write about this. And it's going to be very shameful. Like that's just the nature of it, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting what you say, but because now I'm thinking, there's, you know, we were talking about representation, but there's also this act of disappearing. A lot of writers, you know, once they have moved up, but there's also the chance that, you know, you won't have the means of production and the space and the time, you know, if we think in terms of work and value to acknowledge the fact that your upward mobility was not linear and there is a lot of, you know, stepping back, moving back and forth. And so these kind of narratives, I think they are still ambiguous and fragile, and they don't find a spot. You know, you can also be pushed out from a room that you forcefully tried, you know, to acquire space and move yourself into. So to me, that would be political in a sense. It would be adequate to describe what's going on right now. And I don't think there is a lot of work that is addressing this kind of going back and forth. Or even in the piece, I talk about the city. You were talking about urban spaces. It's been years that we have endless, you know, conversations on the fact that city life is no longer possible as it used to be, the crazy, you know, rental market. If this is such a big argument, how does it clash with transfusion class or class migrants or working class memoirs that are still traditional? So to me, there's this kind of friction that is no longer perhaps producing meaningful work because the general layout or frame has deeply, deeply changed.
Mm-hmm. And but there's something that everyone can understand, which is posing. Right. Can we talk a little bit about like fake working class literature or like fake, you know, hardship stories?
Yeah, the working class and or the faux transfusion class phenomenon, which is, you know, there's tons of examples. And it's something that it's also have a long tradition. Cristina Campo wrote a piece called Scrittori on Show, a writer's own show in the 60s. And she was, you know, not aristocracy, but she handled herself like that. And she was like mocking authors, middle class authors that would pass off as working class just because they had a grandfather or a great grandfather working in the fields or in the mines. And in the 60s, she was saying, it's so funny, you know, to see the writer on TV all of a sudden, you know, getting this kind of melancholic stare and talking about, you know, the poverty in his own remote family. But it brings out a laugh if you think about this posing in the 60s, 70s, when you actually had social mobility. Right now, I mean, I'm personally talking about generic Western countries who had a strong welfare state up until some years ago. But right now, we can say generically that there is such a war on poverty in a lot of cities and countries that it feels a little bit hallucinatory, you know, if not deeply cynical, to want to pass off for working class just to acquire prestige. This says that there's obsession with authenticity. Maybe I'm being too optimistic when I say that Gen Z cares less about, you know, selling out and being authentic and or being a fraud that we did. And so to me, this is deeply related. It really boomed with the millennial ethos in a way. I think they exasperated the idea of having certain street cred or authenticity factors that they would I mean, it was valuable to pass for working class, but now to me is either, you know, new working class, like non-working class authors don't care because the sense of shame and guilt I feel for newer generations doesn't have the still, it's not a stronghold as it used to be. Or they realize that even as you said, economical financial prestige that it would buy to you, maybe that's no longer the case. So the question is, are these transfuge de classe or out of fictional books or memoirs about being underclass still valued so much right now? Or I think this relates to the general question, is out of fiction still such a big, you know, if it's not constantly recoded with new things? So to me, these novels can still have a literary value and an economic value up to the extent where they are trying to bring new things in. Right now, it feels a little bit fossil, I must say.
What, autofiction? Or like the novel, or the novel in general.
That's a little bit of a big statement, but I think, yeah, out of fiction and the connection between the class discourse and out of fiction, if it doesn't deeply rethink itself, it's no longer even valuable from a market perspective.
I mean, in Europe, it's different, I think. In the US, I don't know that it was particularly valuable from a market perspective. And most of its value as a market perspective, at least from the way that I see the way that the literary market in the US has gone for the last 15 years, was mostly as like an import from Europe. The sort of American autofiction authors that are kind of classed with Knausgård and Annie Ernaux and Rachel Cusk are Ben Lerner, who is... His first novel is set in Europe. His most recent novel is about a European intellectual. And Sheila Hetty, who is kind of her own thing, I think, and kind of, I think, drawing much more on like a feminist literary tradition than like an autofictional one, right? So I don't want to talk too much about autofiction because it's my lifelong project to, like, you know, save its name or whatever. But to me, like, it only means the creation of the effect that the narrator or the main character of a novel is the same person whose name is on the cover, right? And you could formally apply that to like any kind of narrative, like it could be any content as long as it seems realistic that Claudia De Santi, it happened to you, right? So you could, I think, if you wanted to do some like posing, right? If you wanted to do like class posing, it would be a really useful form. It's a really useful form to like trick people, right? And to like create like a sneaky little assumption that maybe you grew up poor when your parents actually were lawyers or something.
I have a case study. I was so surprised when I wrote La Straniera, Strangers I Know. It was received also as a class novel in the UK and in France, but it was not the focus so much about that in Germany or the US at all.
Right.
So how the same autofictional book, you know, product could be really read through different lenses.
Yeah. And also, I think it would be interesting to talk about what is the value of writing a novel as such, as opposed to a work of, you know, creative nonfiction, journalism, sociology, or memoir. Because to me, autofiction, the important thing is actually that it remains fiction, like the fiction part. That's like the thing that is interesting, because why not write it as a memoir if it were indeed like mostly true, as people assume. And I wonder what you think, like, because a lot of what you're talking about here is about memoir, but also sometimes you talk about autofiction, sometimes you talk about the novel. What can the novel do now? Like, what is the value of a novel?
It's interesting because a lot of authors working with autofiction based on class, the origins, or the classical French auto-sociobiography, are writing almost always little episodes or chapters in this big autofictional installation. Uh-huh. If you think about Édouard Louis, Annie Ernaux, Didier Deribon. And I'm interested, and I think you're also one of the authors that could understand this, about authors who are trying to transition from different forms. So there's not a lot of case of, you know, writers who are switching from the essay, the autofiction, and the novel. So my answer is deeply influenced by the fact that I wrote novels, then I wrote that autofictional book, and then I had a novel later where I was trying to talk about class, perhaps, in the way, as I said before, large class portraits like Ferrante, Morante, these household names, a list Italian literature that are trying to talk about the underclass and the margins. What was valuable was the fact that for me, it allowed space for different readers, and it also was more intensive as a work and labor experience, if we have to talk about time.
You're talking about fiction.
And labor, yeah, and fiction. It completely upversed my idea of, you know, what's the cost of extracting? What's the cost of crafting? What's the cost of mining? What's the cost of imagining? What's the even the cost of coming up with fictional names for your characters?
Oh, yeah, it's
in a way.
It's like really hard.
So, that's really hard. And I work as a translator mostly. And so when I translate a lot, I go into the memoir out of fictional, which is a lesser degree of fiction compared to a novel mode, because it's highly compatible. Whereas when I'm working on a novel, it has to be a slot of time, energies, and ideas that I can also think about for a long, long time. But it requires a different kind of dedication, which is also an economical dedication in a way. So to me, the reason why we are complaining that there are not big novels is also because we're always obsessed. One of the big questions, as you said, of, you know, the identity, authenticity debate was like, who can afford this?
Mm-hmm.
And right now I'm like, who can really afford a novel knowing that it's not going to land you unless you're going into very far worlds, let's say, where, you know, vampires, dragons, you know, let's say the conventional realistic novel, who can afford it? And perhaps maybe this can be reckless, but I was thinking also about the fact that length has shortened for this kind of novels.
Yeah,
know?
I mean, initially,
unless they are not drawing from genre fiction, you know, that's how you make a bulky novel. And I know because that's what I did, you know, you go into genre. But if you're trying to build a real, let's say, realistic, conventional, traditional novel or what it kind of evokes in our minds, it's the length has shortened. Don't you think that's related to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think like for the last 10 years, people are like, oh, the novels are getting shorter and people are reading less because of attention spans, because of, you know, social media. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I think, like the pressures of the market and like, you know, like which came first, the chicken or the egg, like where people had less time and less money to produce like a long sort of well-researched novel or is it that like people were demanding, like, you know, people were buying these short little autofictional tales, which are basically gossip, right? But I wanted to go back to, you also wrote an essay for Berlin Review in 2024 about like the need and like trend to move beyond autofiction, but still use like some of the lessons in like hybridity that that we learned from it. And you weren't really writing, you didn't think of yourself as writing a memoir, but people kept saying like, oh, you're writing a memoir. And your idea of that book like changed over the course of writing it. But I wonder, this was a very common thing to also in the 2010s, which was female authors specifically would be like, it's not autobiographical, like it's not, even though it obviously was. And I wonder why you had that reaction, which, like I said, like is very common. Like I also sort of did as well.
It was weird, like the cognitive biases we have. I was working on La Straniera and Strangers I Know in a writer's residency in upstate New York. All of a sudden at dinner, there's this big, you know, like literary fight in between Knausgård and Elena Ferrante. Uh-huh. And it was interesting how some of the writers at the table would frame Elena Ferrante's work as autofictional. And Knausgård's work, which is, you know, in every kind of way, you know, it's this glorified statement of autofictional as fictional.
Yeah.
It was the length, it was the tone, it was the gender of the author. To me, it was hallucinating in a way. And I felt how that complete, like, a subversion of what our ideas. Sometimes it doesn't have to do nothing at all with the book we are reading. You know, we suddenly decide that the frame to read that work, that's because it's a domestic experience of a woman, anonymous author. It was, and even, you know, when there was that absurd list of the greatest novels of the 20th century by the New York Times, you know, Elena Ferrante was, and the second volume was the first book mm-hmm. that was voted by the jurors, and it's pinned down as auto-fictional.
And I mean, so it's crazy. It's,
in a way, if you think about that, I think being a woman, and this is where, you know, my gender studies and my feminist sense come forward, I was very aware of the risk of saying, I'm writing about my family, my class upbringing, my migration, and a lot of writers around me would be, oh, you're writing a memoir. And it still felt shameful, you know, like 10 years ago. I'm going to say, no, this is not a memoir. But then, years later, I'm working on a novel, also historical novel, genre novel, a lot of things that happen in there. And I'm surrounded by the same writers. What are you working on? And I'm saying, like, I'm writing a novel as if I was hiding because the value of the novel I've dropped, you know? And there was also almost a guilty and shameful idea at that point that you were not working on the self and you were not eviscerating, you know, your life without understanding that even out of fiction has so many genres within itself in a way. So what we label as out of fiction is not this homogeneous experience, you know, of taking yourself as a character. There are so many things that can go wrong. It can also be surprising why you write that kind of book. But let's say in the typical conventions, yes, my writing in the past few years was really, really obsessed with this idea of shame and guilt and cost with the kind of book I was writing. And I sometimes find it absurd that these conversations around, there's a lot of conversation, a lot of class representation, and maybe less on production, which is really important, you know, mm-hmm. for working class writers.
Yeah. You know, if you think of some, like, if you think of Dickens, right, which, you know, or you think of, like,
poor guy,
old, like, you know, quote unquote, traditional English language novels, class is like a setting, right? It is like a set of historical conditions, but also it is like a set of historical conditions that drive the plot. And it is like the plot would not exist, like the interesting plot would not exist if not for these class, like, transformations that happen in Dickens, right? And it creates like kind of really dynamic, interesting literature. And to me, I think it seems like people don't want, like writers do not want to like take the implications of like a sudden transfusion of cash or like a sudden fall from grace and like imagine or describe, as the case may be, like all of the details and like all of the like mechanisms that like mean this happens and this happens and this happens, you know, right? Like it's there's like a sort of desire to simply like say, here's the class situation, and then not like, I mean, this is kind of a silly like cliche point, but like not like examine like what is going to happen. And that's also, like, I think to do with autofiction, which so many autofictional novels have no plot, like nothing happens in them, right? And like, like there's no one story. It's about like representing an atmosphere. And, you know, I like a lot of these novels, but like there's no like, I got a huge tax bill and then I had to borrow money from my friend and then my friend got mad at me and then my boyfriend dumped me because I was complaining and I was depressed and then I like had to do this and then because I was on the street, like I like, you know, met this guy and then this guy, you know what I mean? Like this kind of like chain of reactions, which we associate with a traditional novel is gone. And I am wondering like why, if you have like a good answer for like why that is. And also if it has something to do with, heightened awareness of stereotypes and a desire to like not represent stereotypes, even if sometimes stereotypes are true. Useful. Oh, yeah. Or they're true, right? I read this interview with you and you were talking about like studying anthropology and beginning your anthropology courses. And the professor said, like, at the beginning of the class, just so you know, like, by the end of the class, you will find that like Southern Italians like are often fighting and Germans are very rigid and like the traffic in Rome is really bad and all these stereotypes like come from somewhere, right? And this made you like really, really mad, right? But then I wonder if your thinking on this has like changed since, you know, you're 18 or whatever that was.
That was the most useful creative writing advice I got. I mean, from my poor late professor, I wanted to drop out of college as soon as I heard that because I thought, you know, this is how am I going to learn how to make all identity and fixed stable identities or what we assume for being such explode. But they are immensely useful. I mean, you have to stop the constantly revisioning of the character and of the self. You know, you cannot, it cannot be a never end bleeding character, even in autofiction, I would say. And so perhaps more, a lot of energy that is dedicated to that should be redistributed in a smarter way. Mm-hmm. In studying a little bit something that is very current, I would call them, with the editing of the piece, going back and forth, we came up with the idea of micro classes, even, you know, the process of leaving the city, going back to the country, maybe coming back. There is a lot of newer gray areas in between the processes of social mobility. But as you said, this requires coming up with a new lexicon, coming up with new stereotypes, coming up even with new metaphors around money. And, you know, this can be also quite fun and exciting and instead of going back to what, you know, I mean, you need to read those books. And as I said, I was shaped by them and I loved reading them. But right now, I no longer find them useful as I do. And I'm kind of hopeful for newer working class writers and that they would focus specifically on what you're saying. Why is this not happening in autofiction? I always imagine autofiction, you know, as a room with, let's say, 3-5 mirrors, and you're focusing on how the mirror makes you bigger, makes you smaller, but it's still pretty much your outline, the way is downsized or enlarged, being resized, that is in the main focus. So if the writing is set on that specifically, that's already a big endeavor, and perhaps you're less focused on the smaller characters' microdynamics, because being focused on them suddenly takes you into the realm of a fictional product, because, you know, there's only a certain amount of set voices that you can have in, mm-hmm. in an autofictional work, unless it's deeply experimental. But that's not what we're talking about here. So perhaps in that way, maybe the working class novel would be more useful in talking or creating a new space, a new setting, class setting for the kind of things we're talking about for this new scenario. Yeah. I think it's going to happen in a novel first. Right. And then when it's acquired and it becomes stable, then auto fiction can play with it. But, you know, it takes Dickens to write a working class memoir or auto fiction. I think in the it's not the dignity or the hierarchy, but I think you have to, reality needs to be processed through a novel before it can become real for your autofiction. At least that was my experience.
Do you mean reality needs to be processed by reading a novel?
Growing up poor, uh-huh. I needed Dickens before I could write about my own poverty. Uh-huh. And so to me, my understanding of how to handle class in a literary work came first for the novel. And this is why I often go back to Dickens and compared to the transfusion class sociological writing. I think it's even, you know, Balzac, Ferrante, Zola, Dickens, mm-hmm. let's say, came before, not only historically, but as, you know, a set of tools. They came before Eddie Bonn and Geoff Dyer and whoever.
And can I ask like a very basic but a very broad and annoying question that many writers are often asked, but I'm going to ask you anyway in this context,
sure.
Which is like, you know, why? This is so annoying. I'm sorry. Why do you write? Because, you know, you're like, oh, I needed to see this before I could do it. But does that mean like you wanted to do it before you read Dickens or something like this? Or like where does the desire come from to represent these stories?
Yeah, that's interesting. I have a very, in this sense, stereotypical experience after my migration from the U.S. to rural Italy. I was deeply isolated, angry, and I wanted to write stories that had nothing to do about my life, but certainly were about people who didn't find a place unless it was in a short story or a novel. So, mm-hmm. you know, the reckless, the outsider, the poor, the addict. I had so many addiction short stories and I never injected anything. So that's a whole thing. But it feels relevant now that I think about it, this idea of finding an avatar misfit for me when I started writing. But I became a writer, I think, when I suddenly engaged with the novel. This is not me being a snob. I write personal essays out of fiction, but I think that's what really allowed me to have a more expansive idea of why I write. The pleasure of making up things was really, really being high for the first time, perhaps. You know, it's the kind of high that I was looking for. And then it doesn't come, I don't know about you, but it never came from out of fiction. To me, out of fiction is, I wouldn't say it's painful because, as I said, it's maybe easier sometimes compared to working a novel, but it does. I think I need writing a novel to go to out of fiction and then go back to the novel to learn new things that I can be writing in the other stuff. So to me, maybe it's this kind of transferring water, like a, you know, a demented child from one glass to the other. So that's my relationship with writing and fiction right now. So I knew very well why I started writing. Why I keep doing it, it's something that in my 40s is ringing in a new way. And I don't want to be, I mean, I don't care talking about, oh, nobody's reading, there's no money and the AI. It's not that. But after a certain amount of work, you realize that the kind of literary career that you imagined, in the sense, oh, I'm going to accomplish this kind of body of work. Mm-hmm. Does a writer ever stop? That's what I'm asking right now about. Does someone who writes stops? There are cases of writers who suddenly stopped. I don't know.
That's... Yeah, I think surely. Or, you know, I think it's difficult to say because so many of the examples we have are like women from the 20th century who like didn't, like they stopped. But, you know, if you looked at their biographies, you would see that, you know, maybe they stopped for like reasons that were out of their control.
Out of control.
Right. Yeah. And like, of course, I think there are also, you know, in my like life, I'm 35. Like, I remember when I started reading like literary journalism and cultural criticism, and there would be all these kind of writers who were talked about, and they were like the sexy young writer who like had one book and it was like the sexy debut, and this was like the most exciting, like most, you know, this person was going to be big, and then they just disappeared and never wrote anything again. That's like another kind of person who probably will not be recorded in much history, or like maybe like we won't be reading their books in 50 years. But the only other example I can think of is like the people, you know, especially directors who are like, I'm retiring, it's my last movie, I'm retiring, it's my last book, and then they like do another one because they can't stay away.
We have a limited life. Yeah, I'm starting to realize that it would take an entire, you know, support system in life to imagine even doing something else, but not out of creative, you know, like inspirational mystical reasons, like in a very pragmatical way. It takes, you know, an entire new life and support system to do something different.
Thanks so much, Claudia. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you. It was great. Thank you.
That was Lauren Euler speaking with Claudia Durastanti. If you want to watch a longer version of their conversation, check out our YouTube channel, where you'll find extended episodes and bonus content with all the guests we've had on Airlift. You can also read Claudia's essay, Literature for the Downwardly Mobile, in our reader number 7, which is out in late June. And of course, you can also find it at blnreview.de, the website where we publish all our stories and audio content. As I mentioned at the top, we are a reader-funded magazine. Your subscription literally allows us to keep doing this work. This episode was edited by Caitlin Roberts. I'm Tobias Haberkorn, editor of Berlin Review. See you next time.